Hello and welcome finally to another episode of Endeavors. So I sort of had this episode in the can for a while, but when I first started to edit it, I noticed that the last few minutes of my first interview with Charlie Samuels had some weird interference. I later realized it was a fan that was on somewhere, and so I spent a while trying to fix it and could not. So, regrettably, I had to cut out the last 5 minutes or so of that interview just because the audio was too poor and I didn't feel comfortable airing it. Also, my life has been a little bit crazy lately. Just new job, a lot of stress, a lot of mental health things, but I'm finally here, and I think I'm finally in a position where I can do this again. So hopefully I'll be back to two episodes a week series very soon, and not sort of once in a blue moon when I can bother to be civilized. That being said, today is a very, very good show. As previously mentioned, I have Charlie Samuels, who is the director of, he's a former skateboarder, still skateboarder, and director of the documentary Virgin Blacktop. I also have on singer-songwriter Gene, who I spoke with earlier this summer, and we're actually gonna start by a song from Gene, that's J-E-E-N, off of her album Gift Shop. This is Family.
Do it.
That was Family by Jean off of her album Gift Shop. And you'll be hearing a little more from Jean later on in the show. Right now, my first guest actually makes his living as a professional photographer. But his first love has always been skateboarding. His debut film premiered at the San Luis Obispo International Film Festival in March of this year and won Best Documentary Skateboard Award at the Paris Surf and Skateboard Film Festival, was a finalist for the Grand Jury Award at the Milan SSFF, Best Skateboard Film at PSFF in Portugal, and a standing ovation at Dock, Utah. It took him 24 years of shooting and hunting down films to put this movie together. Along the way, he married, even skateboarding on his hands down the aisle, and became the father of two, but never forgot his background when he first fell in love with skateboarding in 1975. By practicing in a cemetery in the dark, he was with a group called The Wizards. He is Charlie Samuels, and I spoke with him last month about the film. Charlie Samuels, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here this afternoon.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
So you're the director of the documentary Virgin Blacktop, and I've heard of it been described as sort of Wonder Years meets Lords of Dogtown. But I understand this took you about 25 years to make.
Yeah, 24, 23, I guess, to be exact. People also call it like cross between Boyhood and Dogtown also. It was a labor of love. And I started it in 1994, and you know, movies take a long time if it's a hobby of yours. You know, there's a reason why there's thousands of people in the credits.
Yeah, you know, the world and technology itself has changed so much in 1994. I mean, we're doing a podcast, and the internet wasn't necessarily a thing back then, but. The culture surrounding skateboarding itself, how much do you find that has changed in the last 24 years?
Well, actually, the movie starts in, like, 1969. So, we're really, you know, and then I have all this Super 8 footage of our skateboard team from the late 70s. So, do you want to talk about 94 or you want to talk about...
Yeah, I think... I just think skateboard culture in many ways is like a lot of other subcultures is misunderstood in a lot of ways.
Definitely. Yeah.
So you know, you, as someone who's traced at least a part of its history, what did you notice in its evolution?
Well, I definitely traced most of its history because, you know, depending on who you speak to, skateboarding started probably in the early 60s. So we, you know, the film starts, you know, 4 or 5 years later. And then when we got together, you know, this eclectic group of kids got together in 1977, you know, the biggest change, I think, is then, you know, we had so much passion for skateboarding and each other that we didn't want skateboarding to die. And at that time, the media was portraying it as this incredibly dangerous, crazy sport. So, you know, we were like the anti-skateboarders. We would consciously wear our safety equipment whenever we did demonstrations or went to contests or skateboard parks, wherever we could, because we wanted to reverse that image of, you know, the bad boy image that you could get hurt. We wanted to show, listen, we're taking proper precautions, and, you know, it sounds kind of goody two-shoes, but it's like we really just felt that our passion would die if we didn't do a little bit to help its image. And so, you know, we wore safety equipment as much as we can. And that, I think, is the biggest difference. Now I've changed my mind. You know, I think it's freedom to wear your safety equipment. And, you know, I don't, you know, I wear my gear when I'm skating in a pool or, you know, trying something difficult. So, but it doesn't matter now. You know, it's just the sport has taken on its own momentum. And or the sport of or the culture, it's no longer a subculture. It's a full blown culture that is debuting in the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo now.
And that's an interesting point I want to bring up because, you know, when I was in elementary school and high school, I had a lot of friends that skateboarded, and I still think, at least then, there was still a sense that it was a very youth driven sport or youth driven hobby. But I mean, you and the Wizards are all in your 40s and 50s now and are still skating. So what's your response to the claims, I guess, that it's very much a youth centric sort of world?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because that's another huge difference between the 70s and now. In the 70s, it was thought of as a dangerous toy, wooden toy with wheels. And nobody 20 or older that I can remember would skateboard. Now, it's completely different. It's just another form of exercise. And there are thousands of people that skate in their 50s and 60s right now. There's so many, groups on Facebook that do this. And it's just like any other exercise, and it's no more dangerous than soccer, basketball, or football, possibly even less dangerous, and, statistically. So, it's no big deal to have a huge age range at the skateboard park.
What's it like for you now skating at your age versus when it was when you first started skating in the 70s? Just the safety aspect's one thing, but just the physicality of your body as well would also play a factor.
Yeah, well, I'm 57, and all the Wizards, my skateboard team, are in their 50s, and we all still skate. All of the surviving members, one of us is no longer with us, but and it's not because of skateboarding. the main thing is, when I was a kid in the 70s, all I was focused on is trying to do a creative trick. No matter how I did that, it didn't matter. So I was much stronger, much more limber, much less prone to accidents. But now, what I basically use it as exercise, fun exercise. I might even enjoy it more now in my 50s. And the only difference is, I push myself about, 1/50th as much as I did when I was 17.
Right. You mentioned how it's become a full-blown culture and it's going to appear in the Olympics in a couple of years. And I think for me, I knew about skateboarding from the video games and from somebody like Tony Hawk. How did that that world in sort of the late 80s to mid 90s really, if at all, change people's opinions and perspectives about this world?
About the skateboard world?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, it's not just appearing. I mean, it literally is appearing in the Olympics. It is in the Olympics. It is a sport that is equal to every other sport with equal men and women and equal medals. So it's not guaranteed it'll be in the Olympics 4 years from now. But it's very likely, as Tony Hawk put it, I think the Olympics need us more than we need them right now. And so the difference, I just see it's harder to, you saw Tony Hawk and whatnot. I see the culture as more accepted by the mainstream. That's the biggest thing. they're more tolerant of us, and they we were always great kids, but for some reason the mainstream seemed to think that we weren't, and they had a bad image of it. And now I think they have a good image of it. So that'll only help the relationship between our culture and the mainstream.
I'm reading the press release here, and is it true that the Wizards built the first skateboard ramp in New York City, or was it the first ever?
I keep saying that. I keep not declaring it, but I keep saying maybe this was the first time a ramp was built inside an apartment in New York City, which was 94. And nobody seems to dispute it. It was pretty outrageous at the time. I knew that, but I'm not absolutely sure that was the first time. But I'll tell you this, that union that we had there is what inspired me to make this film. That's like half of it, really. I recorded it on High 8 Video, and I thought I'd, cut a little documentary about it and put it on my documentary show on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, which was a cable access show. And, it seemed like it. Thought, wait a minute, didn't somebody shoot Super 8 film of us, like, back in the 70s? What if I added that film to my show? And then not only did I find all those people that shot us, which is amazing that so many people shot us because we weren't famous at all, but they were really talented shooters. And I said, oh, my God, I found the holy grail, the visual holy grail of our skateboard team and where we came from and how we ushered ourselves through adolescence. I need to make a full-blown documentary out of this, And that's how it really started.
I'm reading, and I'm fascinated by this, that you actually got hooked on skateboarding by practicing in a cemetery. What was it about that environment that you felt was conducive to your, at that time, hobby?
Well, that leads me to why I named the film Virgin Blacktop, A New York Skate Odyssey. I didn't know anybody else except one friend that skateboarded in 1976. And so I used to skate in my cemetery, which was not my cemetery, but across the street was the cemetery. And, I skated alone. And one day they paved my favorite skate spot in the cemetery with new blacktop. And I just thought, this is the coolest thing. That was the biggest dream. I was blown away. I couldn't believe that they paved the surface and made it so much better. And at the time, all I did was flatland skateboarding. That's the most I could dream of. And so I was so excited about it. And so that's why I called it Virgin Blacktop, because that's basically what myself and my team aspired to have. We had no idea there were anything called skate parks, and until we saw them in Skateboarder magazine. So that was the dream, and it happened.
And then, of course, 27 years or 26 years after that, I heard that you skateboarded down the aisle at your wedding.
Yeah.
How did that go over? What made you decide to do that?
Well, I was always planning. I knew where the wedding was going to be held, and it was near a road that was going downhill. And I thought, it would be sunny and that everybody would be outside, and I'd just arrive on my hands skating down the hill in my suit. And then it just poured. And I said, oh, that stinks. I can't do this concept. And for some reason, I had my skateboard with me right before the ceremony was starting, and my best man, who was the first one I skated with back in the day, he said, well, why can't you do it now? And I said, well, look at the under the tent. It's raining so hard that there's water all over the wood there. He's like, so what? And I said, you're right. So what? I'm good at doing handstands. I might as well just do it on the wet wood. And so I just went for it. And it was, you know, a handstand is really kind of an easy trick if you know how to do it. And I can still do it now, 57. So I did it, and the biggest surprise was that the crowd waiting for us just, like, erupted. And I got scared. I was wondering if something else happened, you know, like I thought the tent blew away or something like that. But they were just, I guess, amazed that that's how I entered.
I'm intrigued by what happened during the production in Alabama. Was it a gang shootout that happened?
I'm not sure. It may have been. I was doing an interview with my friend who owned a restaurant, and you know, one of the wizards, and I'm shooting him. You know, I'm not shooting him. I'm filming him. I got to be careful telling this little story. And all of a sudden, we heard pops outside, and I was kind of outside. You know, I was outside at the time, and I look over, and there's a gas station right next to us, and there's two cars circling each other, shooting at each other in the gas station. And so we hit the deck, and you know. And then these cars went away, and my friend goes, "Welcome to the Dirty South." And he just laughed about it, you know.
And I know another cool thing about this film is that it was actually, I believe, edited by another pro skateboarder, both in New York and Paris.
Correct.
And I think people don't realize how global this world and this sport is. What's your sense of its global appeal and its global outreach? Skateboarders around the world, for example.
Well, there's skate parks on every continent. There's skate parks in amazing, you know, almost every country, I think, right now. And it is a global sport now. And there are sports that are much more popular and make much more money that are not global. And it's poised for some pretty big growth. And, you know, a lot of skaters don't, you know, it's controversial how that growth is going to be managed. But, hopefully it will be managed well. And, you know, if it's popular in Paris, then the next Olympics is in a skateboard mecca city as well, which is Paris, which is, if it's popular in Tokyo, the next Summer Olympics is in Paris, and then if it stays in the Olympics after that, it's in Los Angeles, which is the original area of the revolution of skateboarding. So, you know, it could be one street punch.
And that was my interview with the director of Virgin Blacktop, a New York skate odyssey, Charlie Samuels. Apologies, as you can tell, the interview kind of cuts off there. As you can hear, the interference there starting to become a problem. So I had to trim the interview by about 5 or 6 minutes or so. Apologies to Charlie on that one. This is another song by Gene off her album Gift Shop. This one is called May 18th.
The bottom. Can you hear me now?
That was Jean with the song May 18th off of her new album Gift Shop, which was released on September the 14th. The album features anthemic reverb-fueled indie pop and is produced by Jean and mixed by renowned Toronto musician Ian Blurton, who plays guitar on the single Any Moment. But she is more than just a singer-songwriter. She has also written for many recording artists, including Great Big Sea, Serena Ryder, Rez, Hawksley Workman, Brendan Canning, Fua Fua, and Martin McKinney. With Gift Shop, she has honed her unique vintage sound, creating her finest work to date. She released her debut solo LP, Tourist, in 2014, which was immediately picked up by NPR's beloved and influential show, All Songs Considered, who featured the lead single Everywhere I Go, and highlighted Jean in its 9 Creative Musicians You Should Know radio episode in 2015. That attention landed her a feature showcase at TIFF's 2015 Music Cafe. In 2016, her sophomore effort, Modern Life, continued to build on her debut success with Consequence of Sound calling it catchy, anthemic indie pop. She has garnered significant success with product placement or with song placements in various commercials for Google, Panasonic, Estee Lauder, Kraft, BlackBerry, Kia, Rogers, MasterCard, Molson, as well as notable movies and TV shows, including Cook Off, Republic of Doyle, Instant Star, Ruby Gloom, Degrassi, Killjoys, Hockey Wives, Working Moms, MTV Catfish, and MTV Are You the One? This is my conversation with Canadian songstress Jean.
Or am I okay?
You're all right. Well, I'm here with Jean. Hello.
Hey.
How was the drive in? It's way too hot, I think, to be outside for any length of time, isn't it?
Hot and sticky. I had to pee so bad, but I'm good now, like a new person.
Car rides. How do you get used to that as a traveling, touring musician? Just long, endless hours spent on the road.
Just don't think about it too much. 1 foot in front of the other.
Yeah. So you have a new album out. Gift Shop.
Yeah, coming out September 14th.
September 14th. I know you've written a lot for other people as well as yourself. But to decide, and obviously this isn't your first, but to decide, okay, I'm ready to do another project just for me again. What goes into that decision?
Well, to be honest, I do more stuff for myself these days than I've been doing with other people, but I've been around for a while, so, you know, I've been working with lots of people throughout the years, but, I mean, I'm always doing my own stuff. That's always sort of the main drive.
You became quite well known as a songwriter. In terms of your writing process, Does it change with the song? Does it change, you know, if you're writing for yourself versus for another artist or with another project that you're working on? Or do you always sort of have a rhythm and a routine that you get back to?
No, I think it's totally different every time. Like, for instance, last year I went to London, England. I did a writing camp for, like, super pop songs and the ideas. I didn't know anybody. It's totally by myself. You go in a room and you write a song a day and you're matched up with some dude you've never met. And you have to write a song in, you know, 6 to 10 hours. And obviously for my stuff, I don't at all take that approach. Everything's completely different. And for me, my own personal stuff, you know, I have higher standards because I'm putting my name straight on it. So it's a bigger, longer process than 7 hours. Although some songs, I guess I shouldn't say that, the odd song can be a pretty quick write, and it's just luck to draw.
Every writer's different, but how do you, like, for you, when you're at least writing something, or at least sort of plotting out a song, how do you know when it's finished, or do you?
I guess that would be kind of song by song case scenario, you know, like, some, you just have to let go, like, because I think John Lennon quote that says, like, no song is ever finished. Like, you could tweak until you're fucking 95, you know?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think so. And then other cases, you're like, this is perfect. I just like it. I'm not going to touch it anymore. I don't want to mess with it, right? So, everything's sort of different. Each song is sort of different. Like, they're kind of their own little life form, so.
And your new single is Any Moment. What can you tell us about that particular track?
Well, speaking of writing, I wrote that in like 2 seconds, and I had no intentions of putting on the record. I had already written the record. I submitted this to my publisher. I was just like, here's a song, just for the vault, right? And my publisher had a real big reaction to it, and then I sent it to Ian Blurton, who mixed my record, who I just respect like crazy, and he emailed back and said same kind of reaction, and I was like, what the hell? Like, I personally had no reaction to it whatsoever. So anyway, then we went and recorded it properly at Ian's place, just because everybody sort of felt like it needed a bigger sound, and then that was it. But yeah, that's totally opposite of what I was saying before. It was a super quick song, just took me like 4 hours, I think, ish.
And Ian also plays guitar on the song, doesn't he?
Yes, he plays on that song.
What's it like having sort of your producer, mixer also be a collaborating musician on a specific track?
I'm the producer. I produced the record. Ian co-produced that one track. He mixed the record, so it's okay. Pretty different roles.
Right, okay.
But as soon as I, because I was in Cookie Duster with Brendan Canning, and Ian did some mixing on that When Flying Was Easy record, and so I just touched base with him through Twitter and asked if he would consider mixing it, and so that's sort of how we really started working together. And as we just worked more and more together, I just was like, hey, will you play guitar on this song? And he's playing with me tonight, so now he's in my band. It was just one of those, I just clicked with him. I thought he's the greatest, you know, so anything I can get him involved in regarding my stuff, I will try.
You know, when you mentioned sort of the process of that single and how it came to be, what do you think that says about maybe our perceptions of our own work versus an outsider's, you know, perception or perspective on a given piece?
Yeah, that's a complicated question, because I don't know if you are in the arts at all, but if you are, I think whether it's, well, I don't know, maybe it's not even arts, it's any project you do, and you take your time and your effort and your blood, sweat, and tears, and then maybe someone doesn't react, even though you work like crazy on it, and then vice versa, you do something in an afternoon and you don't even give it a second thought, and everybody's freaking out about it. I don't know. It's I don't know what to say about that. Like, it's weird, because something that I personally love the most from my work might not resonate with others, but it resonates with me. But that's music, right? Like,
yeah.
What somebody loves of any song, others hate. Like, it's just so personal, right?
You know, there's a lot of us artists that are fiercely independent and insist on doing everything ourselves, and then those are other genres or other types of artists that really, really, really want to collaborate all the time and have as many people as possible. Where do you fall in that spectrum, would you say?
I'm a bit of an introvert and like more of a loner, so I kind of hide away in my attic and I just do it. I find that's what I've been doing the most, so that's where I'm the most comfortable. I'm just lock myself away, you know. I could do it the other way and maybe have just as good results, if not better results, but at this point in time I'm locking myself away, isolation. But I wonder if the next record will I do that. I don't know, it's a little scary to think about not doing that, because it's comfortable to be by yourself, you know. You don't have to like argue with anyone or
well, and you know and a lot of artists and specifically singer-songwriters that I talk to are just like, yeah, you know, I went to a cabin in the woods for a month and wrote this or this and that. And what is, and in terms of just like the creative mindset, what does being alone and sort of having that isolation do for your overall process, if anything?
Well, I mean, I'm way past the days of needing a special space. Like, I have written in so many dumb ass, not inspiring spaces. I just don't care. I can't afford to do that, you know? I work where I can, when I can, and that's, I don't wait for some, you know, wonderful, lovely environment. It'd be nice, but it's just not reality. I don't know. What was the question again? It was like, like sitting up there.
Yeah, just, you know, sort of just being like the hold up writer, you know, by
it can be all like sorts of things. Like at times you're like freaking out, you're so excited, you just came up with something so amazing, and then there's just this slow process. Then halfway through you're like, this is shit. This sound sucks. And then hopefully you come back around, you're like, no, I got it, I saved it, it's good, you know, it's grueling at times, right? And it can be pretty torturous because I'm my worst critic, right? So I'm just sitting up there with a standard that's so high, you know, and now I'm producing my own stuff now, which I'm not a producer. So every record I do, I'm getting better at that. But past records, I'm like, I was just like flying by the seat of my pants, you know, like, so I'm happy to kind of get there with that. But it's two sort of things I'm doing. I'm learning as I go along with producing, because that's not my thing, but I do it out of necessity. So there's a whole bunch of shit that goes on when I'm locked in that room.
I want to touch on the producing thing, because I think when a lot of artists or musicians start out, they're all about the artistry and the craft, and they don't necessarily know so much about the business side of everything. And as you know, as someone who's now starting to produce stuff, how much have you learned about that aspect of the career and the life that you live?
Well, I've been doing this forever. Like, I'm old, you know, I'm not like a kid. So I've literally been doing this since I was about 15 years old, never had a real job. But the producing thing is probably past 4 or 5 years, because I didn't want to wait around for somebody, right? I didn't want to pay somebody.
Yeah.
So, but I said, I'm literally learning as I go along. So when I go and listen to something that I did 3 years ago, I'm like, oh my God, like, you know, but I'm learning in real time. I'm releasing things, you know, just to keep my sanity. But I do feel like this record, I'm starting to get a bit of a stride with the producing. I'm starting to know what not to do, you know, but I am like learning in real time. That's the only problem. So some of my past stuff I can listen to now, I'm like, oh. But anyway, onward, right?
Yeah.
Forward.
I was struck by how many TV shows and ads your music has appeared in. And I think that's another aspect that a lot of musicians learn about, is sort of the licensing and selling your songs to be used out where. I know there are some artists that don't want to say, I don't want my work used in this context or this specific thing or this.
No pornography.
Right. But in terms of how sort of that part of your career came about, do you remember how that started and how much you learned about the importance of maybe licensing your music to get it out there more in a way?
Yeah, I mean, in this day and age, if you don't do that, I don't know how the fuck you're surviving, because even when you're doing that, it's hard to survive as a musician. Like, it's never been harder. It's never been worse. People value music very little when it comes to money. Like, people kind of think it's free, I feel. So if you really want to make a living, not have a real job, then you're going to have to maybe bend your morals a touch. Like, I'm a 90s kid, so back then it was like, selling out was everything, you know, like those bands that I grew up listening to, and I was in a band at the time, you just would never ever, because it was just, you wouldn't want to be a sellout. But now it's like, I don't know, man, I don't know how else anybody, how you make money.
Yeah.
Like, if you're gonna get oh high and mighty about not selling your stuff to an ad or a movie or a show, what are you gonna do? You're gonna live in a box, or you're gonna be working at McDonald's. Because you gotta make a living, right?
Yeah.
That's my perspective. I don't know who's lucky enough to just do every single thing they would like and still be able to make a career. You know, you gotta bend a little here and there.
You know, given how much not only the industry has changed in the last 10 years, but even technology and sort of how we access not just music, but, you know, literature, theater, whatever. Is it easier or harder to be an artist today, do you think, than it was maybe when you first started out?
Well, I think it's bleaker. Like, I think it's harder to make a career, right? And like an actual, I'm making money. That's how I pay my rent or my mortgage. That's how I feed my kids. That's how I eat. I think that's harder. But it's way easier to get your stuff out to people. right? So you can access people and people can access you in the blink of an eye. There's never been easier for that, right? But I don't know if that's been a good thing or a bad thing, you know, because I think that has added to the undervaluing of some things, yeah. And just a onslaught of fucking bands too. Like, it's so oversaturated that that also adds to the undervaluing of maybe things that are more quality out there, because there's just so much content.
We hear about that word exposure a lot, you know, like, oh, it's like, we don't get paid, but what is your opinion of, like, when someone says exposure,
I mean, there's truth to it, right? Like, exposure is a big deal. You gotta get to people. If you get too uptight about needing money for everything, then you're probably shooting yourself in the foot, you know? But there's a fine line, because you just can't undervalue yourself to the point that you're just doing everything for free so people see, like, who gives a shit? Like, do you want to do it as a job and a career, or do you want to do it as a hobby, right? Mm-hmm. Exposure is essential. I guess exposure is essential for both, whether it's a hobby or a career, right?
Yeah.
You got to be careful, like, not to just do everything for nothing, because then you're, what are you saying to people?
I guess, in terms of the saturation you talked about, how much harder is it to stand out, and how do you do that in this type of environment?
I'm still figuring that out. Dan, I don't know, man. Maybe ask me in a year. I hope I have some awesome answer. Like, I got it. I succeeded to where I needed to get to, but I guess you get to certain levels, and there's always the next level, right?
Yeah.
Like, you're always looking at the next rung on the ladder or whatever, but I don't know. I don't really have an answer to that. I don't know.
Would you say you have a favorite track off of Gift Shop?
It's not out, so nobody could even hear it. I really like Jungle. I'm going to actually release that as a third single, so that'll come out before, and Medicate Me. Those two, I guess, would probably be kind of closest to me on the record, and the Medicate Me is going to come out, I think it's like August 10th. And then Jungle will come out September 7th, and then the record follows. So those two of my favorites will be out a little beforehand, but I'd say those are my two favorites.
All right. Well, the album is Gift Shop, and it comes out in September, and you're here tonight at the Monarch Tavern.
Yes, sir.
Gene, thanks so much.
Thanks.
That was my conversation with singer-songwriter, the alt-pop songstress Jean. Her new album, Gift Shop, was released on September 18th through Red Brick Songs. That's it for me today. Thanks for tuning in. Hope to be back next week with another new show. We're going to take you out with Jean's single, Any Moment, off her album, Gift Shop. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.